Real Talk, the Customer Insights Show with Christoph Trapp, a top-rated live stream and podcast in the market research and insights industry. We stream live on LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube, and you can listen on all major podcast channels and watch on dbtv.tv. Join Christoph and his guests for a weekly discussion around topics that will help you understand your customers better. Real Talk is presented to you by VoxPopMe, the leader in video research for over a decade. Here's today's conversation.
Hello, insights professionals, marketers, and anyone who wants to understand their customers better. We're here to talk about that exact topic. Now, what's interesting to me is we're returning back to the topic of empathy. We talked about the empathy gap before with Rob Volpe, who, of course, wrote the book on the topic as well. But how do you actually become an empathetic researcher? So I asked Reggie Murphy to come on the show. He's the senior director of UX research at Zendesk. Ran across him many, many years ago, feels like it. A long time ago on, I believe, on Twitter. And then we connected on LinkedIn. So I wanted to find out, he calls himself an empathetic researcher. So certainly he makes a point to do that in his professional career. But how do we do that? What can you learn from him? What can I learn from him? Let's get him on the show. Hey, Reggie, nice to see you.
It's good to meet you. Finally, we're able to put this together. I know we've been trying for quite some time. So happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
You bet. It's always something to be said about talking to people face to face, even when it's virtual, as opposed to just text-based communication.
Absolutely.
Really, really appreciate you. Now, to get us started, tell us about your career a little bit, and especially as an empathetic researcher. What have you done? Just a quick highlight over your career stops.
Sure. I'll tell you a little bit about it. So it first started when I was in college. I went in undergraduate school at Appalachian State University. I went there with the intention to become a news reporter. And so I was majoring in communications, and someone said, you should change that major to history or some liberal arts. So I ended up changing my major to history, but I was still involved with the campus radio station. And I recall them asking me to, as a news reporter, to conduct an interview with a classically trained harpist that was coming to campus in a couple of weeks. And when I think back and reflect back at that period of time, I had no idea that this would lead to a future in research, because I was planning to be a news reporter at that time. But I was conducting that interview and talking about his life and how he became a classically trained pianist, and I mean, a harpist, as well as a pianist. He was also a pianist. And just his background and how he loved to play music. And it just set off a light bulb in my head about investigations and news investigations. So at that time I had planned to be a journalist, but then after undergraduate school, I decided to continue on to graduate school and joined a master's program in communications. And it was then when I started working on projects that were related to audience analysis and audience insights and research. And that propelled me into just the media field. So once I finished school, master's and PhD, I joined the private research industry and became connected with a company that we did essentially research and consulting for media companies. And that started the career. And I began, this was early in the days of the internet. So everybody was hiring companies to help them understand how to build websites and all. And so after a couple of years at that company and learning usability research and conducting large scale market research studies, both, you know, so I was doing both quantitative and qualitative research. I joined a company where I stayed for about 12 years. It was a media company. And that's when I basically learned all of the foundations of conducting research from, you know, qual and quant, digital analytics, when the internet was really taking off. And at that company, right after the recession, we took a step back and tried to really set forth an innovation strategy at the company. And so we hired a company called IDEO. I'm pretty sure a lot of marketers and research professionals know about IDEO. And it was at that point where I really learned human-centered design, design thinking. And my career took a different turn after that, because after I left that company, I joined another company that this is all we focused on, was trying to help companies use design thinking methods to create new products and processes. And that opened a whole lot of doors for me professionally, but in terms of just conducting interviews and becoming a much more of an expert in qualitative research methodologies as well as quant, that sort of just, you know, set me in another direction. Oh, you're back. I see.
Go ahead.
Your video's back on. And so after spending about 3.5 years at that company, I joined Facebook and then Vanguard and then Twitter. And in each of those roles, you know, I worked on some amazing products and features, you know, with social media, obviously, and then financial services company like Vanguard. And deploying all types of different types of methodologies, you know, both qual and quant, and traveling the world and conducting research in different places around the company, around the world. That only enhanced my, you know, skill set and expertise in conducting both qual and quant research.
It's awesome to see. And, you know, it's interesting to me, you're not the only person that went into news reporting. That's where I started. In fact, I went to school to be a sports writer. I never worked a day in my life as a sports writer, but I did work in the news business. And you know what? I still use those skills today. In fact, I'm using them right now, right this second, right? Like, how am I curious? How do I ask better questions? How do I get, you know, get you to be comfortable as my guest, right? Those are all skills I think journalists learn. But what's interesting to me is I never thought of what I do as like I'm being empathetic. Like, I mean, I am, right? Like, especially as a news reporter, when I would talk to, like, let's say a victim, a family where, you know, somebody was murdered, I definitely had to be empathetic. But I never actually thought, like, I have to be really empathetic now, right? I would just be empathetic, right? If that makes sense. But you really made the point to call it out, right? It's important to be empathetic. We need to be empathetic researchers. Can I talk about that? What is an empathetic researcher, and why is it important to call that out?
Well, I've thought about this, and there's really three things that I think about when I think about what an empathetic researcher is number one, you care. All right. You are curious. And you're conscientious. And I think those are, if you remember those three things, you will, that'll certainly get you started. But being empathetic is just, it's about making that connection. And you said so yourself, especially if you're an investigative news reporter and you're interviewing a family that has gone through some type of traumatic event, you have to care. And it's about making a connection. And that's, especially when you're doing qualitative research, is truly, truly connecting with someone. That's part one, is you are making that connection. But the other part to it is about understanding what your own biases are and the assumptions that you bring to your research projects. We're all human beings. So we all have cognitive biases. We all have a lived experience. We all have belief systems, values, the way we live our lives. And it's important that for every project that we work on, that you try to understand what your own biases are so that you check those at the door and you recognize what they are. So for whatever topic, whatever whatever customer that you're going to, or whatever user that you're going to interview, you understand what those are and how they may have some impact on how you're approaching that particular interview, because it will affect it if you allow it to. And so you have to develop that sort of sixth sense to say, okay, whoa, you know, these are my biases and this is the topic that I'm covering. So how am I going to create an interview guide and how I'm going to structure the questions that I'm going to ask this person in the best way possible to truly understand their world. I remember when I was in graduate school, and this is what really clued me into like what empathy really is as a researcher. I was sitting in a qualitative research class with a professor who was a pure qualitative researcher. And one thing he said sticks to me to this day. As a matter of fact, I use it in presentations whenever I give talks. He says, as a qualitative researcher, or as a researcher, your goal is to try to see the world as others see it. To truly walk in someone else's shoes, it is very difficult to do. And as a research interviewer, as a moderator, it's one thing that you really have to do, because it's to sort of understand what your biases are, and then truly try to get into the world of the person who you're interviewing. And you have a lot of tools at your disposal as a researcher. There's a lot of methods in order to conduct the interview, but to be truly empathetic, you have to be 100% dialed in and attentive and actively listening. I can talk about that in detail later, but it's I call it hyper observant. Mm-hmm. And so it's truly important as an interviewer to, you know, in order to be that way.
You know, when you talk about all the different methods, I mean, you're correct. There's so many different methods. And I did a LinkedIn poll yesterday on the Vox Pop Me LinkedIn page, and I ran out of answers to put all the different methods,
there's
right?
So many.
There's way too many. But let me just, so here's what I said. Which research method do you prefer? And I said, in-depth interview, live focus group, asynchronous video surveys. It depends on the study. Right. And of course, 60% answered, it depends on the study, which is also what I would say. And 40% said in-depth interview. Does how you practice empathy, does it depend on what method you use? I mean, if I'm thinking, like if you and I are talking, right? Very different level of empathy, because we're seeing each other, we're looking at each other, we see how people react versus, I don't know, me reading somebody's responses, whether they're from open ends, text or video, right? I mean, how do you kind of, how does that look in practice?
You approach it the same way, because there are these sort of values, there's standards. Especially if you're doing an interview, no matter what method you're using, you are, you know, you're actively listening. You are, you're focusing on how a person is, you know, especially, you know, what the person is saying. And especially if in the interview, if they're pausing a little bit in between what they're saying, something is there. So as an interviewer, you're trying to allow this person. Well, let me take a step back. The first thing you're doing, or you want to do, is you're setting the environment so that the person feels comfortable with you. So you're developing rapport. You are, you know, you're offering water. You are, you know, all the sort of the beginning things as a person is getting settled and comfortable. And so you want to set the scene for that person to be able to feel like they can share and be open with you. So that's your first task. But the other task in the middle of the interview, as you're going through it, is you're, as I said, you're actively listening, but you're observing, you're reading body language, especially if the person isn't opening up at first. And you are trying to identify moments of, well, maybe the person is maybe saying something a little bit more on the surface. And, you know, you allow the person to sort of finish their comment, and then maybe they go on to something else, but maybe you go back to something that they had mentioned, or maybe they paused a little bit, or I remember in usability testing, what we would do, and I think you know, this still happens, is, you know, someone is sort of looking at an interface and they're trying to go through it, and maybe they're doing a task-based usability test, and they may get through it, but, you know, you see frowns, you see you see them, you know, cringing at various points, but they're, you know, finishing the task. You know, there's something there. Maybe they finished the task, but, you know, it was a struggle getting through it. And so you saw that struggle on their face because you recognized it as the empathetic researcher. And you, afterwards, you say, hey, you know, I saw that you got through that, you know, pretty well, but it looked like you were struggling a little bit. And the person may say, no, I wasn't struggling. That's just how my face is. But they may say, yeah, I was. And then that propels the conversation into a deeper area. And so that's what you want to be doing, is that you want to be recognizing those moments where the interviewee is saying something but not saying it, either through body language or through some behavior. And that helps you learn more and get a little deeper with them.
Let's circle back on the importance of seeing people in a minute. But the one example that came to my mind was when Nick Graham was on the show of Mondelez. He was testing some kind of, I think he called it a mid-calorie drink. Uh-huh. And they kept asking people, what do you think of this mid-calorie drink? Yeah. And they were all like, yeah, it's a good idea. But he says, but just the way they answered it, you could tell that they were like, yeah, it sounds like a good idea.
Right.
But why do we need it? Like, and so you have to really ask, you know, ask follow-up questions. And you couldn't just go, oh, yeah, everybody said they're going to buy it, which, you know, no, they didn't say that. They kind of did, but they didn't. Yeah. How important is it, though, to see people? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, if you're just reading somebody's open-end text question, you know, text answer, I mean, you're not going to be able to pick up on those things, right? So is the importance of seeing people, is that, how do you feel about that?
It's really challenging. If, again, all of this depends on the scope of your work, budget you have, all of that. And if the only method that you have the budget for and time to do is deploy a research survey, a quant study, and let's say you have some open ends, you do the best you can. You try to read, let's say you have a set of open ends, you just try to conduct a text analysis as best as you can. And yeah, that you have to make some discernment around what people are writing, what people are saying. And that's part of your job. That's you know, that's your profession. And you try to do the best you can to be diligent in reading through what, and try to synthesize and look at themes that emerge so that you're not honing in on sort of one person's comment. You know, you're looking at the totality of all of the comments, and you know, as a professional, you learn how to do that. So it's very challenging for quant research when all you have is open ends. I think if you have the ability to do mixed methods project and you have both quant as well as qualitative research, then you're able to sort of check both, and it helps you do the analysis at the end, because you're able to look at all of these data and make sense of it. I think as it's certainly a lot easier to sort of discern meaning when you're face to face with someone or virtual interview. It's certainly a lot easier to do it that way, but oftentimes you don't get that luxury in terms of budgets and time.
Absolutely, and certainly some of the technology does make it easier. But you also, I think you also got to ask the right questions at the right time. I mean, I was thinking about a survey, Reggie, that I took the other day. And after every question, they said, please explain. And I'm like, there's nothing to explain. The service was great. 10 out of 10.
Right.
And more like one time, it was really bad. Like, I could give you more details why it was bad, but I think it was just they were having a bad day. So, like, how do you pick when to actually dive deeper? Do you know what I mean? I mean, you could do, I think we had, I remember his name now, who was talking about it, but, you know, do like a mixed method, or like even, you know, quant, qual, quant or something like that. So how do you figure out what to dive deeper on and what not to?
Well, it depends on, again, the scope of the project and what question you're trying to answer and what the problem is that you're trying to solve for. That determines, especially if you're doing a quant study, that determines the set of questions that you're using. But if you only have the ability to put, usually only have maybe three or four open ends in a 20 question quant survey, let's say that for example, you have to be really particular about what follow-ups, you know, that you're going to, you know, get a open, use an open-ended question for. And again, it will depend. It will depend on, you know, again, what's your initial research question that you are going after in the study, as to which question that you need to set an open-ended question up for. I think a lot of my answers are going to say it depends, Christoph. But it does, because if you are intentional and deliberate, and again, I use the word conscientious about the work and what you want to learn, then, you know, all research is not going to look, all research projects don't look the same. And you can't just sort of use a cookie cutter approach to it. And again, it's being empathetic when you are designing the study for the particular focus of the topic at hand.
You know, and certainly I hear you on the whole it depends thing. I mean, even I'm complaining about the LinkedIn LinkedIn poll. I don't have enough answers, but yet I one of my answers will
one
be
one of your answers. It depends, and it does. And I could see why all the data points, the majority of the data points would be focused there, because it does.
Yeah, it's true. You know, we had Nikki Lavoy on the show, and she talked about holistic insights. And we've had other people too, like Megan Kerr from PepsiCo, when she talked about, you know, we want to know all kinds of things about you. Yes, we want to know what that you drink Pepsi and when you drink it and why you drink it and whatever. But what else affects your life, right? So some people call that holistic insights. How important is it to actually look at the person as a whole? What else is impacting them? And at the end of the day, I don't want to say everything competes with everything, but everything certainly competes with my attention.
Yeah, I agree. As human, you know, I've learned over the years, you know, human beings are very complicated. We are filled with contradictions, and we say a lot about what we do, but if you look at what we do, it's sometimes different than what we say we do. And so it's important, if you want to get paint a holistic picture of the customer, you've got to leverage all of the various data and research assets at your disposal. There's large, medium, and small companies with large, medium, and small budgets. So, if you're on the bigger company size and you have access to, say, Forrester or Gartner or big research studies from Kantar or Ipsos or some of those bigger companies, then they produce a lot of segmentation studies. So you try to leverage, that kind of data, market landscape data. Maybe if you're a consumer product goes, you know, purchasing behavior is really huge there. Churn data, attrition data, buying patterns. You know, all of the quant research, you certainly want to pay attention to if you have access to it and have budget for it and all of that, because that paints a part of the picture. But then, yeah, you're talking about the holistic person. Now you're talking about this complicated human being that you're trying to figure out either, you know, why are they not buying this product, or what really is the problem that they're trying to solve. So now you have to deploy some other methods. Okay, maybe it's in-home interviews if you're able to do it. Maybe it's virtual interviews, group sessions. If you're conducting a foundation, again, it depends. So if the work that you're doing is foundational, you're trying to really uncover and unearth something that is truly foundational research, then it's important to look at all of these different tools at your disposal to try to paint, because at the end of the day, what you want to do is you want to paint, as you say, you know, a picture about this person, warts and all, as to how they behave and how they think about the problem it is that they're trying to solve and how products are helping them solve that problem. Because I go back to this, is that especially if you're being, if you're back to the question about how you, how should you be an empathetic researcher? One of the things you got to do is take the time to figure out or to understand what is the problem that the person is trying to solve for. Because I've seen many projects over the years come about because a company has already built something. And, oh, now we got to see if customers like it. Totally the wrong way to do it. Now, if your product is successful in that way, you're doing it that way, fine. I don't know how many there are in the world, but if you get lucky, great. But you are trying to do it the other way around. You're trying to understand what the problems are that people are trying to solve in their lives. And hopefully that inspires you, inspires your team to develop something then to solve that problem. And then you figure out, hey, is it viable for it? You know, for that product to be sold in the marketplace. I think it's really important that you are, as a researcher, trying to figure out what their problem is. Now, sometimes you may go into a project and the problem that the customer is trying to solve is still a little opaque. You don't really know. It could be one, you have some hunches. You may have some ideas or some assumptions, but sometimes you really don't know. So the research, the early stage of the research project is to help try to define what that problem is. And I think that's truly important, because once you establish that, then it makes the remainder of your project, the rest of the journey of the life cycle of the project a whole lot easier, because you've identified the thing that you're trying to understand as you are going out and talking to customers or users.
Yeah, you can look at the totality of the situation. The other thing that I was thinking about as you were talking, Reggie, was sometimes it's not about the product at all, right? When sometimes people say to me, hey, how come you're not doing this one thing at this one time, and or why you're not participating in this one thing? And I'm thinking, because the Yankees are playing. I'm watching the Yankees. Like, has nothing to do with your product. It has just something to do that I have to purchase or use it at that specific time. So sometimes, you know, keep that in mind. And I think that's kind of where when I hear everybody talk about holistic insights, like, you need to know every little bitty thing about me. Probably not. But you need to know the things that affect how I make my decision as it relates to your product.
Absolutely. Because you have, you know, especially folks, you know, if you're parents and, you know, there's children involved, you know, you have to get them up and get them going for maybe, you know, school in the morning. And there is this whole life that someone is living. And we are, you know, as human, you know, we're using different tools to live our lives. And it's important for you to understand that backdrop. Because if not, then you'll start over rotating on things that you hear in research, but you're not factoring in. Yeah, the thing is like, oh yeah. And what you think is a problem is really not a problem. it just so happens that at that moment in time, in that person's context, that you may have seen an interview that you watched, that they were doing something different. But while it's a small part, it wasn't the critical part that you need to really focus on in order to solve their problem.
It's just interesting. There's so many different variables, so many different things going on in everybody's life. And certainly we want to make everything we do a success. Let's shift for the last segment here. Let's shift a little bit. We talked about, you know, the getting the research, talking to people, but let's talk about when you try to drive action within your company. How do you actually, So you're in a focus group, and for example, let's just pick on that example, a live interview, and you can be empathetic in there, but how do you take that empathy and bring it to the boardroom or your stakeholders, and how do you make sure that they feel that same level of empathy and make the right decisions?
Hopefully, if you have designed your project in the best way possible, your stakeholders have been along for the ride the entire life cycle of the project. Like, as an empathetic researcher, you want to brief them at the very beginning, the kickoff and planning meetings, of to set expectations. Here's what we're trying to learn, and here's the focus. And so, and you've been checking in along the way. As a matter of fact, some of your stakeholders may have been involved in attending some of the sessions or taking notes and involved in the debrief. So by the time the final presentation is, it's not some big reveal. It's kind of a continuation of discussions that have happened in the previous debrief meetings. So they've already, hopefully they've already sort of seen a lot of what you're going to kind of distill in this sort of big picture presentation. But some of the things that it's really important to do in order to really bring your stakeholders into the world of what you studied with your customer, I mean, photos and videos. Yeah, I can't stress that enough. And I think in the true sort of world of, you know, when conducting especially ethnographies, you know, you're taking video and you are finding really interesting things to bring back, but you clip together some of the most important parts of the themes that surfaced in the work, and you put together a video reel about it. Having customers talk about these issues or the problems or the struggles or the pains or the delights and joys that they have. Compelling. As long as I've been doing this, it's showing actual customers talking about your stakeholders' products in a real way. And one piece of this that I didn't mention earlier about being true empathy is that when you're doing your analysis, you're not skipping over anything. You're being true to what the customer really said, and you're not worried about, you know, hurting a stakeholder's feelings. It's about telling the real story. And so you're doing that through video or photos or artifacts. I love to do this. In some projects, we would do storyboarding, drawing, and we'd have customers sort of draw their experience, you know, doing a process or something. And it was very fascinating watching them. And we tell them to put smiley faces and frowny faces on the across the journey if something was going well or something wasn't going well. And some of them are very, very creative when they do this. And I love bringing those back into the session with the stakeholders at the end, because they can actually see customers' actual drawings and seeing them in the video talking about that drawing. And it just sort of pulls people in. It's like, oh, now I really see how that customer was thinking and feeling and what they were doing and how they talked about it in a very, very real way. So I think it's sort of a combination of those things that I think really helps your stakeholders be as empathetic as you are.
You know, it all comes back to visuals, whether that's video or, as you mentioned, a picture or even those emojis, I guess, or smiley faces or whatever it might be. Because, you know, I mean, I'm a writer by training and by heart, but at the end of the day, right, it's much harder to read stuff as opposed to seeing the visual.
Go ahead.
Right. Reggie, really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much for sharing your insights.
Enjoy talking with you. I'm glad we were able to put it together. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Absolutely. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in today. I'll be back next week with two episodes, Karen Kraft of Johnsonville and Gia Lotti with her new book on how to do a customer-led strategy. See you then.